Mr. Black, reel 10. What happened next, Mr. Black?
Well, from Southborough, again, we were more or less permanently based at Southborough at this particular time. Wherever we went, we came back to Great Bounds Camp. We moved up to Clacton. That was for a firing camp. We used to fire along the seafront there. Actually, it was the best accommodation we'd had for a while because we're in Butland's holiday camp. And other people were billeted in decent places round the town. We did quite a bit of firing there.
They'd be firing out to sea,
Firing out to sea, firing the drogue targets again. I think it was there we had our first experience of one of these wireless controlled aircraft, target aircraft. This was quite interesting because the drogues eventually became literally a soft target. I mean, we knew the speed that they were flying, we knew the direction they were flying, and it wasn't really good training for what we were supposed to do. As it turned out, I mean, for the concentration of both our gun nets, we didn't get a lot of shooting at aircraft. We did a bit when we finally went into France. From Clacton, we moved back into Southborough. Did quite a bit of training in the right from the October over the Christmas to the February. We had quite a decent spell in the camp. But again, it was the normal sort of routine, a bit more of the spit and polish type routine because we were established. Chance to get maintenance done. But it was all leading up because it was the invasion obviously then was becoming very, very imminent. From Southborough, again, we may have made a big move up the country. We came right across to Egremont on the Cumbrian coast. And this time the regiment moved in a full convoy. We moved from Southborough through London. And that's when we had the escort of police right through London through the Blackwall Tunnel. It was closed off while the regiment was passing through. This liaison with the police, of course, all had to be done from regimental headquarters, and of course the movement control. Moved right up the country, across to, and we went across. Hartside Pass, which is one of the awkward passes in the Lake District. We had two overnight stops on the way up because obviously a convoy, you're only travelling 30 miles an hour, and that is what it's about, a 350 mile journey. We lagered up for the night in two places. There were camps that had been established by our advance party, so it wasn't a question of going down there and sort of having to get yourself bedded down. The things were more or less provided for you. There was a meal ready for you and this sort of thing.
There were hooded camps, were they?
Yes. They tried to find some place where there was sort of facilities, where there had to be a sort of mess hall and this sort of thing for a big movement of troops like that. But when you got there, you were ready for a decent rest, a decent spell, because I was riding a motorcycle all the way. But you never got that spell because when you got there, you had your meal, and then the OC would probably call for an operations party for to discuss the next move, the next day's move, and this sort of thing. So it was always fairly late before you got turned in. Eventually, as I say, we got up as far as Hartside, and we'd had a very long journey. It was bitterly cold, because we're in February. When we crossed Hartside, I was a little bit in advance of the convoy, getting ready to direct them through and, if necessary, stop traffic as the convoy is coming through, and I saw the Hartside Cafe, and I've always loved that place afterwards, because I went in there and I said, any chance of a cup? Oh, certainly. So I had a smashing cup of tea, and the best of it, it's the simple things at times that you really think about. He says, would you like a slice of fried bread? I says, oh, I would. And you know, that tasted wonderful. It was only fried bread, but it tasted like manna.
What so date was this?
That was February 1944.
What were you doing there when you got to Egremont?
Well, at Egremont, it was again a firing camp. It seemed a bit strange that they move you to all these various places in the country just to do a firing exercise. But, of course, again, it was movement control. I mean, you're exercising both things, your firing ability and the ability to move a regiment, which, again, it proved very important. We spent, we didn't spend very long at Egremont, just I think it was about a fortnight. Then we went back to Southborough. But when we got to Southborough, we got that was the March we got back, and we were told then that we were definitely scheduled for the invasion of Europe. That we were to be with the 12th Corps. One of our batteries, not the battery that I had at the time, I was still with 364, they were destined to go across with the forerunner of 12th Corps, and they were going to go just two or three days after D-Day to get a place for to establish the Corps when it came across. And from then on, our training led right up to that. But then we were... D-Day came, and then we were very disappointed, because that's when Jerry started to send his flying bombs over, and we were told that we'd been put back from the D-Day, or the just after the D-Day assault, to go against the flying bombs. And the troop was, in this time we didn't move very far, we just moved outside of Salborough. Actually, my troop went up to Penshurst Place, the big Penshurst Castle that you quite often see on television. And we sighted the guns round there and had quite a lot of shots at these flying bombs. So it made up in a way the fact that we weren't going to go across as soon as we anticipated. But it's there we had the... I don't know whether it was... It could have been the one and only action that we had on the Bofors gun, and I was standing next to the one of the guns that was sighted quite close to the troop headquarters, and the firing at this doodlebugs that went across, and suddenly there was an almighty bang just overhead, and I saw the number four, who was the firing operator on the gun, he just fell to the ground. And we rushed and picked him up. Best part of his head was blown away. Whether that had been a misfire from the gun or shrapnel, because the heavies were also engaged in these flying bombs, we don't know. But he was still alive. We got him to hospital, but he died in hospital. That was really our first literally active service fatality.
Do you recall his name?
Yeah, it was Briggs, Gunnar Briggs. He was one of the intake. He didn't belong round here.
It must have had a profound effect upon you.
Oh yes, time. I mean it was, as I say, it was our first. Although you're sort of you're literally brought up to expect. You're in a war. You do expect them when you see something like that for the first time, sort of. In anger, I mean, you'd seen other things, as I said, I've not mentioned before. It did have quite an effect on us.
Did you have any success against the
Yes, we would. I think with the regiment itself, I think it brought down four flying bombs.
Did your particular troop have any success?
We had one. Yes.
Do you recall that particular instance?
Well, just there's not much to recall. You sort of claim it for yourself because we were actually firing at it, and it we saw the explosion at tip, but of course at the same time the heavies were firing. So the thing that I thought about at the time, I thought, well, you know, we're knocking this thing out of the sky to prevent it getting to London, but what about the people that's going, because it's going to explode anyway, and I mean there's going to be there's probably going to be casualties. As it happened, most of them they fell in open countryside round there, and there wasn't a lot of casualties.
Is there any particular plan for attacking and firing on?
It's just similar to firing at an aircraft. The only advantage is, of course, it's a constant speed, and you have a chance to have a go at it. But I mean, they had to be very close before you could have a go. I mean, 5,000 yards. They were coming, some of them much higher than that.
And what speed did they travel then?
I should think they travel about 150, 200 miles an hour, possibly. Not as fast as the jets or anything like that. They literally droned across.
And did any land near you and explode?
No, we didn't have any landing near to us. They were close enough when they were coming overhead. In that time, while we're in Great Bounds, they were allowed for your wife to come down, and if you could find digs round about, well, she'd come. And Hilda was down there at the time, and we're in our digs. I had a 24-hour leave at the time, and this one just droned across, and Hilda hadn't any idea what it was. She didn't know what on earth was happening, and it was a bit of an eerie experience.
When were you married? During the war?
Yes, 1943. It was actually when we're down at Saunton Stands, when we're doing that pre-infantry training.
Did you have to get permission to marry?
Yes. This is, people laugh nowadays, but you hear people asking for, permission of the father and one thing and another for to marry, but I always say, well, I can go one better. I had to ask the colonel. I had to get permission from the colonel. You had to write into the colonel for permission to marry. That's an old, I don't know whether you know it, but it's an old tradition that dates back when the principally the local, when it was county regiments and local regiments, the colonel was the father of the regiment. And that's why, so the story goes, that's why you had to ask his permission.
And no problems, of course.
No problems, none at all.
And did they give you leave to do?
Well, I got leave, yes.
And were you married down there? Or?
No, I was married up here, yes.
What was the next move for you?
When we're at Penshurst until about the third week in June. And then we got information that we were to move, ready to cross into Northwest Europe. One of our batteries had already moved out and gone across with the advance battery of 12th Corps, and we were scheduled to follow. We went from Southborough to Brentwood in Essex for to join the invasion party, and then from there we moved back into Greys and Stanford Lee Hope, and we embarked there for the invasion.
Just before we come there, can you remember being at Lark Hill to do?
I was at Lark Hill. The regiment wasn't. I think I don't know what I mentioned previously about having a course on firing enemy weapons. I did that course at Lark Hill, not with the regiment. I had actually had 3 weeks there, and we fired all sorts of queer weapons, from naval guns to anti-aircraft guns.
Yes, I mentioned that earlier.
Right.
I thought that there'd been a troop or a battery or regiment at Lark Hill.
No, well, whether or not any other batteries went there, because we did do our separate things. And
so you were down now to the marshalling area.
We're down at Greer's marshalling area.
What was the scene? Can you remember? I mean, it must have been an enormous amount of bustling and activity.
Actually, you see, most of the initial invasion forces had left, and it was literally there now the follow up forces. We spent although we're in Greer's, I think we were on there about beginning of July. Most of them had moved on. And we spent about 3-4 days in Essex, in Greer's, literally waiting. This now became waiting, because you had to literally wait for transport and wait for orders to go. Eventually, we got on board, moved into the channel. And we were marooned in the channel for about 7 days. That was when they had the big storm in the channel, and of course Mulberry Harbour and everything was washed away.
Had you had anything to protection put on your vehicles for landing in water?
Yes, we did. That was all part of our sort of latter training at Southborough. The waterproofed the vehicles.
Now, what did they use for that?
Well, it was principally a waterproof type of grease and this sort of thing. The vulnerable parts were covered up. Exhaust pipes extended so they came above the water. As it happened, we didn't have to use them, because the vehicles were lifted ashore. Because rather than go on a landing craft, as we'd been trained for, we were put aboard this American Liberty ship. William H. Phipps, I remember that name.
What was it like on a ship of that size? It was meant to carry guns and.
Oh no, no! It was principally a cargo ship that had been adapted. I mean, it was one of these Liberty ships that had been built for a one-way crossing of the Atlantic, really.
It was American crew.
American crew, American captain.
So you'd now be close to American.
Oh yes, we found them very, very, very friendly. They used to. We were supposed to be on sort of hard tack rations then, but they saw that we got some fresh baked bread for our breakfast from the galley and this sort of thing. It wasn't bad, really. We of course, naturally, there was no training being done then. We had to amuse ourselves, and we amused ourselves at night time with a sort of concert on the ship's deck. And it was amazing how some of the officers came to fore there and the entertainment. I mean, we found some good singers, some good storytellers, and amongst ourselves.
You'd have heard, obviously by then you'd have heard how the D-Day landing
had gone. I mean, we knew that they were more or less, they'd landed, got pretty well inland, but were then being held up. That is why they began to ship all these, all the extra, the backups in. And of course, I think with that storm, the Tret certainly put them back quite a bit. Actually, I was one of the first to go off the ship. Because the American skipper, it had been his first trip across, and he wanted to get ashore because he wanted a souvenir to take home. So I was instructed to take my motorcycle and take the captain on the pillion and drive towards the front to get him his souvenir. So it was the. I mean, instead of what we've been used to, scrambling nets, getting off in one thing and another. The motorcycle was lifted up by the derricks, and he and I were dropped by the derricks as well.
Did he get his souvenir?
He got it, but I mean, it nearly cost us because can we drive just a bit further? I mean, they were getting around to Capraque Aerodrome and these sort of places. But we're in the Bocage country, and you just didn't know where, even at that stage. I mean, they'd been ashore for quite, well, a few weeks, but there were still pockets of German infantry, and you didn't know where they were going to pop up, because these Bocage country, it was the worst country in the world for fighting in. I mean, it's thick hedges, and you didn't know who was on the other side. And we were driving along the road to get where we thought the front line was, and were suddenly stopped by a military policeman wanting to know where we're going. Of course, an American Merchant Navy captain on the back. So we said, he says, "You'll get a souvenir, all right." He says, "If you go any further," he says, "you'll go down there," and he says, "you'll not come back." So that we, I don't know what sort of, I think you eventually got a, it wasn't a weapon he picked up, it was just some sort of German equipment, the equivalent of the weapon equipment. He got something anyhow and brought it back to the ship.
What was your immediate view of the beach as you approached it?
It was still active and a bit confused. I mean, the beach marshals were still there, and they got you onto the beach. And they hurried you off the beach as well, because there was still occasional shelling on the beaches. We didn't experience anything like the immediate D-Day thing. I mean, there was nobody sort of firing us with small arms or anything like that. As I say, just the shelling. We got off the beach and got.
Was it? Were the beaches crowded, packed with?
No, I wouldn't say they were crowded. I mean, when we landed, there was only our vehicles coming on. There was plenty of debris on the beach. I mean, there was still a lot of burnt out vehicles and submerged vehicles and this sort of thing that you had to avoid as you came ashore. See, the William Phipps, she lay off, and the guns were lowered into landing craft and just brought ashore. And then we sort of lagered about 6 or 7 miles from the beach, and it's there where I first saw the casualties, because there was still some heavy fighting going on there. And I remember driving down the road and seeing this. I couldn't think what it was. My goodness, they are taking it easy. And there was a row of soldiers. Turned out they were guardsmen. There was about a dozen of them in a row, just lying. You'd think all the world that they were asleep. They were asleep, well and truly. But the thing that always stuck in my mind, and it's always the little thing, I looked and I saw their boots, and their boots were absolutely shining. Beautifully polished. They were dead. They were the first casualties that I saw.
What day did you land?
We landed about the the 12th of July.
And where exactly did they put you down?
With Goldsmith Beach.
Gold Beach?
Gold, yes, Gold.
And your first impressions of France? Did you have much chance to have an impression of France?
The first impressions were, I mean, we saw the same things as you probably see on the films these days. The initial houses sort of burnt out and this sort of thing. But when we got inland and got lagered down, I received my first bad impression, and that was that we were billeted round about a farmhouse, and the farmer and his wife there. They weren't too happy with us, and they were full of the Bosch back. We found this to be quite even when we got further inland and we were trying to use our liberation currency. No. They wouldn't accept it at some places because they thought that the Germans in France. I wouldn't say were received enthusiastically by Southern. Whether ours was a sort of different experience to other people, I don't know.
If these were wanting Germans back, in effect.
Well, in effect, they were saying that. But of course, when you talk to people, they'll say, "Well, you know, you literally knocked hell out of their country, so they're going to be a trifle upset, as it were." Whether it was that or not the other, I don't know. But I think some of them hadn't had such a bad time when the Germans, especially the farmers, were producing sort of grub for them. I think it was the cities that felt the impact.
So they weren't cooperative at all?
They weren't cooperative.
And were there many of the civilians about?
No, there wasn't a lot, just the odd. As I say, again, we were probably out in the sticks, in the countryside, and it just small, not even a village, a little hamlet or a farmhouse or something like that.
Was there a lot of destruction?
There was a fair bit, especially around the Falaise area and Capricorn Aerodrome. There was tremendous destruction there. I mean, there was burnt out vehicles, there was cows lying dead, and the stench was terrible.
And this first stop, as you say, was about six miles inland.
Yeah.
Do you know whereabouts it was in? What was the name of any?
Well, we went into. As I say, we landed on the Goldsmith area, Normandy, just the Arromanches piece left, and it was the Soules where we sort of lagered overnight, which is just between the beach and the Capricorn Aerodrome.